This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is one of the first times that we've seen an election produce a challenger who is going to replace an incumbent who has essentially accepted the results and is now contesting it. It's a rarity in Africa to see incumbents gracefully accept defeat.
That's Professor Kweku Nuama, Senior Professorial Lecturer and Chair of the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University in Washington, on the runoff election results in Liberia. Details coming up. Also, the African Union criticizes Israel's response to Hamas's attack last month as inexcusable. And former U.S. First Lady Rosalynn Carter, the wife of President Jimmy Carter, has died at age 96. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. As Israeli troops focus on clearing medical facilities where they say Hamas militants take cover, the Hamas-led Gaza Health Ministry today said a shell hit the second floor of the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza, killing at least 12 people. The fighting came a day after the World Health Organization evacuated 28 premature babies from Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, where they were among more than 250 critically ill or wounded patients stranded there after Israeli forces entered the compound. The infants were taken to hospitals in Egypt. Israel says Hamas uses civilians and hospitals as shields. Hamas and hospital workers deny that fighters operate from within hospital compounds. Today in Germany, the French news agency AFP reports that African Union chairman Azel Osamani told journalists Israel's response to Hamas's attack last month was inexcusable, warning that civilian casualties would fuel further extremism. There is growing criticism from around the world that Israel's bombardment and fighting in Gaza is collectively punishing Palestinian civilians after Hamas militants attacked Israeli communities and killed about 1,200 people in early October. More than 11,500 Palestinians, two-thirds of them women and minors, have been killed since the war began, according to Palestinian health authorities. Also today, Nepal's foreign minister says a Nepalese student held hostage in Gaza is still in captivity but is in good health. Narayan Parkash Saud said, according to information received by Nepal's embassy in Israel, that the student identified as Bipin Joshi was not injured. Saud said efforts are being made to get him freed. There are international negotiations going on to free the nearly 240 hostages Hamas still holds in Gaza, but there has been no clear breakthrough in the talks. Video shot today in northern Israel shows extensive damage following a claim by the Israeli military that several artillery launches from Lebanon had struck the area. It comes as the Israeli Defense Forces said its artillery struck several locations in Lebanon. For more on the latest developments in the conflict, we have journalist Linda Gradstein on the line from Jerusalem. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Linda.
Thank you, Yehia.
So let's start with Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza. What is the Israeli government and Hamas saying about its status?
Well, the hospital has been basically taken over by Israel, and Israel had long been saying that it there was a tunnel network underneath it and that Hamas was using it as a command and control center, and at least until yesterday, they didn't have any real concrete evidence. Yesterday, they uncovered a tunnel that goes deep underground, about 30 meters underground, ending in a blast door with even an elevator, and they also showed surveillance footage from the cameras in the hospital that showed Hamas bringing in two hostages, one from Nepal and one from Thailand, one of whom was wounded. And so Israel says it's clear proof that Hamas is using the hospitals for non-military, you know, for military purposes and non-civilian purposes.
So have all the patients been evacuated?
Yes, almost all the patients have been evacuated. There were a bunch of babies, premature babies, who were evacuated by the Palestinian Red Crescent with Israeli help. They were put in incubators and taken to Rafah, to the Egyptian border, and then brought to Egypt. Originally, there were 36 babies. Unfortunately, both during the fighting and in the transition, seven of those babies died, and 29 were taken to Egypt. There are still a few hundred patients in Shifa Hospital and medical staff. But most of the fighting was actually around a different hospital today. Palestinians say that at least 12 people were killed when Israeli tanks surrounded the hospital. The fighting is still primarily in northern Gaza, but in southern Gaza, where there are almost more than a million displaced people, and the United Nations officials say that the schools and other UN facilities are at more than nine times the capacity that they were meant to hold.
And now that you've mentioned southern Gaza, Doctors Without Borders said it is treating dozens of patients, including children, for severe burns at Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza after an Israeli airstrike nearby. Is there anything you know about that?
Yes, just that Israel says it is trying to avoid civilian casualties and that it only launches airstrikes when it knows that there are Hamas operatives in the area. Hamas says there are no Hamas operatives and that it's a hospital. Gaza is so densely populated that it seems almost impossible that civilians won't be hit in any Israeli airstrike.
And there has been shelling up in northern Israel. What is known about that?
Yes, in fact, the tensions have been growing between Israel and Hezbollah, and a Hezbollah rocket hit an Israeli army base today in north, right on the border, doing extensive damage to that. And Israel has, nobody was hurt, and there are very few civilians left. Israel has evacuated everybody from a lot of Lebanese communities near the Lebanon border. And I actually just heard today from a friend of mine who is a social worker with some of these communities in hotels that they're expected to be in these hotels. They told people that they should plan to be there until April. So that means they don't feel that this is ending, at least on the Lebanese border, anytime soon.
And what is known about the hostage situations, negotiations?
So there have been these ongoing negotiations headed by Qatar and Egypt for a small hostage release. In other words, 50 hostages over 5 days, 10 per day, and a five-day ceasefire on Israel. And yesterday there were reports, for example, in the Washington Post that the deal was imminent. Israel has since said, well, it may not be happening that quickly, but there's still talk that it will happen. However, if, the fighting intensifies, that's going to make it harder for it to happen. So the families of the hostages last week marched from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and by the end there were 30,000 people, and families and relatives were just begging the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to do whatever he could to get even some of them back. Israel is somewhat concerned that a five-day ceasefire will allow Hamas to rearm. The idea is to allow in a lot of humanitarian aid during those 5 days, but Israel is also worried that, 5 days is going to lead to a lot of pressure to continue that ceasefire.
So anything else you can tell us, Linda, besides that?
The only other thing is that Jordan has opened a field hospital in Khan Yunis. And the other thing that 1,000 boats on Thursday are supposedly set up to leave Turkey for Gaza and Ashdod to try to break the Israeli blockade and have said that they will not stop even if Israel orders them to stop. So I think we can expect another week of tension.
Tension, yes. Linda Granstein in Jerusalem, thank you for your input.
Thank you, Yehias. Bye-bye.
Liberian President George Weah has conceded defeat after provisional results from last week's runoff vote show challenger Joseph Boakai beating him by just over a percentage point. "The Liberian people have spoken and we have heard their voice," Weah said in an address to the nation, adding that Boakai is in a lead that we cannot surpass. Professor Kweku Nuama, senior professorial lecturer and chair of the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University, tells me it's a rarity in Africa for incumbents to gracefully accept defeat.
"This is one of the first times that we've seen an election produce a challenger who is going to replace an incumbent who has essentially accepted the results and is not contesting it. It's a rarity in Africa to see incumbents gracefully accept defeat. And for Liberia, this is a new chapter in their democracy. I think it's something that we should all take note of and appreciate, and thank George Weah for, you know, having the grace and decency not to turn his country into a battlefield over an election that he clearly lost, but accepting the defeat and wishing the incoming president well."
"Yes," he said, "the Liberian people have spoken and we have heard their voice," and he urged his followers to follow his example and accept the results of the elections.
"We came in at a time when Liberia was dealing with all kinds of problems, and then of course, COVID came in as well, added to those problems. Mm-hmm. I think Liberia's economic challenges have persisted. There's been allegations of misrule and corruption. But generally, when an incumbent is voted out, it means that the people are not satisfied with the work he has done and are not going to renew the contract. And that should be part of the democratic game in Africa. Well, leaders come in and they understand that at the end of your tenure, you're going to be evaluated. And when you are found wanting, the people have a right to change and put somebody else in there. And Boakai also needs to understand that what happened to Weah can also happen to him at the end of his first term if he doesn't deliver. And this is part of how you build democracy. We need to have the opportunity to reward leaders who perform well and to punish leaders who don't. And so I hope that going forward, this becomes part of Liberia's tradition."
"And being a superstar, a super soccer player, but at one point you have to actually produce, you have to fulfill promises."
"Exactly. It's not enough to be famous. And, you know, George Weah was good for Liberia. He was good for all Africans, especially in the dark periods of the Civil War. His patriotism cannot be questioned, but it's not enough. You have to deliver. When you sign up for the most important job in the country, particularly in a struggling country, you have to be more than famous and you have to be more than somebody that wishes to do well. You actually have to do good works for the people. It's not enough to have good intentions and to have a famous name and to even be patriotic. Those things are important, but it's not enough. It's not a sufficient condition. You have to actually deliver. You have to solve problems. And I don't think that he was able to do it. And the next best thing that he could have done was gracefully accept his defeat and move aside for somebody else to take over the mantle. We hope other leaders can learn from that. And we hope that others will also accept defeat gracefully when they lose. There is still life beyond the president. George Weah is young. There are a lot of failed leaders in Africa who have gone on to second lives as public leaders of important public institutions, or even important lives in public diplomacy. If you look around the continent, you see former leaders leading election monitoring missions for the African Union, doing mediation work, heading institutions. So George Weah is still relatively young. He can move on to another career. Being a president is not the only way you can serve your people. And we need to understand that, and more leaders need to understand that exiting the presidency is not the end of your political life.
That was Professor Kweku Nuama, senior professorial lecturer and chair of the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University, speaking with me here in Washington, D.C. Kenya Railways says cargo services to Mombasa's port have resumed after floods damaged a section of track over the weekend. Heavy rains linked to the El Niño phenomenon, followed by flash floods, have submerged towns across East Africa, leaving hundreds of thousands of people homeless. In Kenya, the death toll stood at 52 as of Friday and is expected to rise. Reuters says loading and offloading of cargo has restarted, while the passenger service is also operating normally. Railway officials say they are working around the clock to minimize delays. Some environmentalists and activists calling for reduced plastic pollution say talks in Kenya to set up the world's first treaty to curb plastic pollution did not make nearly enough progress. Helen Kaosodena, Pan-African Plastic Project lead for Greenpeace Africa, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the talks that ended late last night drew more than 500 proposals from governments, but negotiators did not strike a deal.
The third intergovernmental negotiating committee really ended on a disappointing note, simply because countries failed to agree on the intersessional work that is supposed to happen between now and the I-94 in Canada. And most of these oil and gas producing countries were dictating the terms of, you know, the negotiations. They were negotiating in bad faith. At the beginning of the week, there was this, low ambition or, self-proclaimed countries, Saudi Arabia, Iran, basically just oil producing countries. And they really, want to prioritize, downstream measures as opposed to upstream measures. So as at yesterday, when the meeting ended, really there was no agreement in terms of some of the institutional work that was going to go ahead.
Why is plastic such a concern worldwide? I mean, what is the harm of discarded plastics, especially in Africa?
Plastic is, very toxic. It pollutes the environment, but more than that, it also impacts on human health. We know that it's a triple planetary crisis. So we're talking of impacts on climate crisis, but also biodiversity loss and pollution. But more than that, studies have shown that there are microplastics in the air that we breathe, in the water that we drink, and some have even been found in, a bloodstream of human beings. So we are not just talking about, negative impacts on the environment, but also on our own health. And for Africa specifically, Africa is not really a major producer of plastics, but still bears the brunt when it comes to, the impacts of plastic pollution. Africa also has the added burden of, plastic waste dumping, what has now come to be popularly known as waste colonialism. So we see countries from the global north scrambling to dump plastic waste into Africa and turn Africa into a dumpster.
So did the leaders that were attending this meeting agree to anything?
Of course, the other stuff that they agreed on, things like, waste management, all of them are agreed. So the real contentious issue here is, a reduction in production, because when you speak about things like the primary plastic polymers, that's where the core of the issue is, because they do not want to reduce, production on that. But you see, if the treaty in itself is supposed to deal with plastic pollution, but you cannot deal with pollution without looking at how do you cut production, how do you reduce production. That's where the bone of contention is.
What is your message to oil-producing countries and, this idea of corporate capture of plastic pollutants?
For oil-producing countries, really, they should not put profit before people and the planet, because this is not just about profit. They're actually looking at their own interests versus the interests of the other, the environment, but also the health of human beings.
That's Helen Kaosodena, Pan-African Plastic Project lead for Greenpeace Africa, who attended the talks. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam in Nairobi. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has died at the age of 96. VOA's Ken Fabo, who extensively covered her life and post-White House career promoting global health and democracy with her husband, former President Jimmy Carter, has more.
Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter acknowledged the secret to her nearly 80-year-long marriage to President Jimmy Carter was space and respect.
We grew to respect each other. I respect what he could do. He would respect what I could do. And from then on, it's just been a really wonderful partnership.
Eleanor Rosalynn Smith Carter was born in Plains, Georgia on August 18, 1927, and lived in the small peanut farming town during the Great Depression.
I had a really wonderful childhood until I was 13 when my daddy died, and that was sad. But we were poor, but everybody else was poor. We didn't even know we were poor because we had food in the garden and we had a cow in the backyard with milk, and mother made all my clothes.
She grew up familiar with the son of a local peanut farmer, James Earl Carter Jr., better known as Jimmy.
When he was 16, for instance, a senior in high school, I was 13, his little sister's friend. I never ever dreamed I'd go with him.
But on a visit back to Plains in 1946, while attending the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, Jimmy Carter proposed.
When I asked Rosalynn to marry me the first time, she said no. That was in February, and it wasn't until May that she changed her mind and decided to get married.
They married in Plains on July 7th, 1946. Mrs. Carter followed her husband during his naval career and gave birth to three sons, John Jack Carter, James Earl Carter III, or Chip, and Jeff. Daughter Amy was born later in 1967. The family returned to Plains in 1953 to take over the Carter peanut farming business, which Mrs. Carter managed even after her husband decided to enter politics in 1962.
But he got up one morning, and instead of putting on his khakis to go to work at the farm supply business, he put on his Sunday pants. And I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to see who's going to run for the state Senate."
After contesting the results of that election, Carter won, launching his political career that eventually carried them into Georgia's governor's mansion in 1970 and the White House in 1977. While campaigning to help get her husband elected, Mrs. Carter heard a similar concern from voters.
Every single day that I campaigned, I had somebody ask me what I would do for a mentally ill loved one.
As First Lady of the United States, Carter used her platform to advocate for mental health, forming a presidential commission to address the issue. She traveled the world the rest of her life, working to remove the stigma associated with those suffering from mental illness.
Everybody in our country can realize that it's just an illness like any other illness.
President Carter encouraged his wife's prominent role in his administration and sought her counsel throughout his tenure, including during the Camp David Accords, which ended a state of war between Israel and Egypt.
It was one of the most exciting, I think, thrilling days of my life. And I was standing with Mrs. Begin. Prime Minister Begin got to her before Jimmy got to me. And he came up and he said, "Mama, we're going to go down in history for this."
The hostage crisis in Iran contributed to Carter's presidential election defeat to Republican Ronald Reagan in 1980. And the couple returned to Plains, Georgia in 1981 to plan their post-presidential life, which Jimmy Carter told her he wanted to be different.
"I have an idea about what we can do with the rest of our lives." He said, "We can have a place kind of like Camp David where we can negotiate a peace agreement." So that was the germ of the idea for the Carter Center.
Founded in 1982, the Carter Center today is one of the leading global nonprofit organizations working to wage peace, fight disease, and build hope to underserved populations throughout the world. Under Rosalynn and Jimmy Carter's leadership, the Carter Center has monitored more than 100 elections, treated millions of people suffering neglected tropical diseases, and is on the verge of total eradication of guinea worm. It also gave Rosalynn Carter the means to continue her work in mental health advocacy globally.
"That's what I wish for, that people go for help and get help and lead good lives."
Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter are the longest married presidential couple in U.S. history.
"And my life's been an adventure."
As her husband entered hospice care toward the end of his life, the Carter family announced the former First Lady was suffering from dementia. She spent her final years alongside Jimmy Carter in the small town of Plains, where they were born and grew up nearly a century before. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.